This is the Finimize podcast. I'm your host, Eddie Donmez.
My perspective on tech is, yes, great companies, but don't assume that they will be great forever, or at least don't pay any price for them. And I haven't been able to verify this, by the way, but I've read numbers that suggested about 90% of the upside we saw from the S&P 500 and US stocks in the first quarter of the year came from a very small handful of stocks. Now, again, I can see why they have haven appeal, net cash, competitive positions, tech worked brilliantly, but that's all very reminiscent of the Nifty 50 mentality that we saw in the early 1970s when there were 50 stocks that just dominated. And said, well, if you own those 50, what can go wrong? If you overpay for them, everything.
In this episode, I'm joined by Russ Mould, an investment director at AJ Bell. In the conversation, we take a look at the current economic picture and what it means for you and your investments. I hope you enjoy the episode. So, Russ, could you please walk me through your big picture macro view right now?
I can gallop you through it, and it's a very, very confusing situation. And that much is obvious from the fact that even central bankers don't quite know what to do. You know, we've gone from being inflation to being transitory to being a challenge. We've gone from there being no recession to now the Fed's saying there's going to be a mild recession. So, you know, their crystal ball is cloudy, and I think it's fair to say that mine is as well. And we've still got three outcomes possible. We could still get inflation. We could still get disinflation / deflation. We could conceivably still get the worst of all worlds, which is stagflation, which is possibly, you could argue, what the UK is suffering right now with a series of GDP prints that begin 0.something with inflation at still north of 10%. Now, we're obviously hoping that inflation figure will come down, and I think the maths will favour that. But you know, there is still a legitimate case to be made for all three of those different scenarios, inflation, deflation, stagflation. And where do I think we'll end up? Personally, I still think that the chances on a recession are actually pretty high. I know that the Office for Budget Responsibility said it thinks we can dodge a technical recession. I know the Davos crowd have become a bit more positive, and although the IMF probably slightly trimmed its global GDP growth numbers, it still seems to think we can just about dodge a global recession. But if you look at a situation whereby we've had no real downturn barring the COVID lockdown inspired one that was short, sharp, we haven't really had a downturn for 15 years or so. You know, that's highly unusual. How have central banks managed to keep the plate spinning when they've done it through cheap money, through encouraging debt? So you've effectively encouraging borrowing. So you've effectively tried to solve what was a debt crisis by encouraging people to borrow more. I'm not sure that's a lasting solution, if the truth be told. And it may work so long as debt stays incredibly cheap. But now that, you know, money is more expensive and debt are more expensive, I think there will be an inevitable hit from that. And we have to bear in mind that monetary policy probably operates with a 12 to 18 month lag. We're 15 months into the UK raising interest rates and 12 months into America doing so, less for Europe. So we probably yet haven't seen the real impact of that monetary tightening. That will probably start to emerge in the next 12 to 18 months. If you look at the US, you can argue that the strongest indicators are lagging: unemployment, jobs. The concurrent indicators, things like retail sales, housing sales, are starting to show signs of duress. And some of the leading indicators you would look at, with it buried within the purchasing managers' indices, hiring intentions, investment intentions, or job vacancies, they're starting to soften. So I think you can still make a strong case for a recession. And I think the strongest case for avoiding that rests on lagging indicators, which I'd be least keen to rely upon. And so I think base case, I think a recession is still distinctly possible. And I think that if you look at the history of central banks, they're only human. They're well-intended. They're smart, but they're only human. They will get things wrong. I don't think the Federal Reserve has ever accurately predicted a recession. And if you look at its history, generally speaking, the Fed has raised rates until something has broken, either the economy or financial markets or both. And so I arguing it's going to be different this time, I think, is a pretty brave thing to do. And it takes you back to the old Rudy Dornbush quote, the US economics professor. You know, no American economic upturn died in its bed of old age. They were all murdered in their bed by the US Federal Reserve.
Yeah, well, we definitely saw things breaking with Silicon Valley Bank. And obviously, when I was doing my research on you, saw that you were a managing director at UBS as well. So your former firm has been busy, to say the least. I also saw you covered tech stocks as well as an analyst. So something arguably has broke. what's next to come? What could potentially break moving forward? There's lots of rumors about commercial real estate as a kind of cascading warning signs. Yet when you look at tech stocks, you know, given your background, we've got Google up, Apple up, you know, more double digits, Microsoft up 18%, Apple up 23%. So how do investors start to comprehend the weakening economic picture with a differing potentially market picture?
Yeah, I think first of all, we've got to be careful that financial markets and the economy aren't necessarily the same thing. You know, as we know, I mean, in theory, financial markets are forward-looking discounting mechanisms, particularly equities. So they will move a lot, or they should move when they're working properly. They'll move a lot before the economy does. So the theory that you tend to see is what you're really looking at, and certainly, I guess, if you're a trader particularly, but even if you're an investor, is what you're looking at is a change in the rate of change. So the second derivative. So the market psychology will very much be, ooh, look, it's getting worse, not good, share price goes down. Ooh, it's getting worse, but more slowly. And if it's getting worse more slowly, then it will eventually stop getting worse. And if it stops getting worse, then it will eventually start getting better. And so what markets will do is they'll try and preempt that getting better by moving in when things are getting bad, but less quickly. And so that's when you'll tend to see cyclical stocks move, for example, or interest rate sensitives move, because the market will start to discount central banks moving. And we may come back to this later, but you know, if you look, the US and UK 2-year bond yields on government paper, treasuries in the US and gilts in the UK, they tend to move 6 months before the central banks do. Now, it's therefore desperately tempting to any libertarian or true free market believer to say, well, we can sack all the central bankers and get rid of all those expensive economists because they've never predicted any recession in their life, and you can just rely on the 2-year yield to do everything for you and let the market price money properly. And it's desperately tempting, but you know, the history of markets being what it is, there's always going to be some wise person who'll try and fiddle the 2-year rate just like they were allegedly fiddling LIBOR. So you can probably argue that, you know, central banks are the least worst option that we have available to us. So markets will try and preempt that. So financial market is not just the economy, but I think where we've been with the financial markets in the last 6 months, with, and this is equities as well as fixed income, is that certainly from that October rally onwards that we saw, markets were pricing in a cooling in inflation, a pause and then a pivot in central bank interest rates, with the result that we would then have a soft landing or indeed no landing at all economically. 1, 2, 3. And I think the reason then that markets have probably become a little bit more challenged in the last month is that that reassuring narrative has been challenged. Inflation's been a bit sticky in the UK, and even the core numbers in the US are still not coming down as fast as the Fed might like. And that's potentially put, you know, hopes, certainly initially there were hopes for a pivot in policy in July. Yeah, that's not quite so clear now. And now the Fed is saying, well, actually, there could be a mild recession after all, and maybe that's a price worth paying to get inflation down. So those three tenets have come under more duress recently, and that's why I think you've seen some of the sort of big rally that we saw from the autumn run out with a little bit of puff. As to why tech's going up, it's a really good one. You're right. I started actually as a fund manager in 1991. And I moved to the sell side as an investment analyst in investment bank in 93 and did tech. I saw tech go all the way up. The technology investment research team where I started initially had 4 people, peaked at 60 odd, and then finished at about 8 when I left. So you can see how the cycle changes. And I think the reason that you're seeing tech coming back into fashion right now is I think that's fairly, you could argue it's fairly classic bear market stuff in that we've been conditioned to buy on the dips for the last 15 years. So it's a very hard habit to break because also it's been a successful strategy, generally speaking. B, I think that it's still unclear whether we are seeing a major shift economically from what we've been used to. In the last 15 years, we've had low growth, low rates, low inflation. It's not impossible we'll go back there. That disinflationary scenario we talked about at the start, the IMF hinted as much in its paper this week in its Washington meeting. And if you do go back to low growth, low rate, low inflation sludge, it's a perfect environment for long duration assets like tech, biotech, and long dated government paper. However, if the environment really is going to change and we do see a return to the 1970 style environment of inflation or stagflation, it's an awful environment historically for long dated assets, like long duration assets like tech, biotech and bonds. And then you need to be in short duration assets, cyclicals, real stuff, commodities. So I think at the moment, investors are still very much conditioned by what they've seen over the last 10 or 15 years, and understandably so, because in some ways it's the environment, the only environment some of them have ever seen. But for all fossils like me, who've been doing this for 30 odd years, who have seen different environments, I think if you do see a change, it would be in the backdrop, it would be unwise to assume that what's worked for the last 10 or 15 years will work again in the future, because we may end up in a different environment. And at the moment, it feels like that's maybe the case. So yes, I think a recession is possible. I think equally we could still get some stagflation, and equally I think it may be that inflation, for all the fact we get a slowdown, proves a little bit more resilient than we hope at the moment.
I just want to pull on that a little bit more, because you're obviously extremely experienced in that kind of tech space, and you know, maybe in the 2000s era, etc., it was very high growth, maybe not too much cash flow generating assets. Whereas now the world's changed, right? Tech dominates our world. And what you're seeing, in my kind of opinion, is almost like a flight to safety, right? In those Microsofts, those Apples, they do produce cash flow. They are money-making machines. And actually, they've got, you know, secular tailwinds, plus maybe this overlay of AI. And maybe investors are kind of flocking to those as a safe haven play. So how has your interpretation of tech stocks changed throughout your career, from when you covered them almost first to now? Has your view changed of them?
Not as such, because I think if you look at tech over time, you know, the one constant is change. And so I think therefore it's very, very, you have to be careful to assume that the winners of today will be the winners of tomorrow. And I agree with you at the moment. You know, if you are looking for a haven, things with net cash balance sheets, with very powerful competitive positions, are a good place to start, because a powerful competitive position can give you pricing power, which at some of inflation helps to shield you. And you can argue that all of, you know, Apple, to a degree, you know, Meta, Alphabet, Amazon has a powerful competitive position, but it's having trouble monetizing it, though AWS is a money-making machine. Microsoft, those are incredibly powerful franchises, with, to a degree, captive customer bases who are locked in because they know the operating system, they like it, they don't want to change and adopt a different one. And so I can see why they are treated as havens for sure. I think the danger that you have there is that even disruptors can be disrupted. I mean, remember, Apple did have a near-death experience under John Sculley, and it took Steve Jobs to come back and dig it out of trouble. Microsoft has successfully reinvented itself once, whether it can do it, and it's been a phenomenal success. Amazon's core business is challenged at the moment because it's not making any money on delivery and retail. So I wouldn't want to rely on all of them implicitly. And if you look at the history of tech over time, yes, we started off, you know, with, if you look at previous tech booms, whether it's, gosh, if you go all the way back, you know, pocket calculators was a big boom for tech and semiconductor stocks in the early 1970s. Then you had, you know, mini computers and microcomputers, then you had desktops, then you had mainframes, then you had desktop, or you had mainframes and mini computers, then desktops, then smartphones. These things come and go, and there's always something else coming up along the pipe. And AI may indeed be a fantastic thing, but it is also a potential challenge, I would suspect, if you're, you know, Alphabet with the Google utility of search, which it is, it's a phenomenal tool, but it could be a challenge to that as well as an opportunity. So I think my one caveat with tech is you wouldn't want to rely on it implicitly, or at least pay too high a price for it. And I think, again, that's something that we're finding out. You know, we did find out is that, you know, when Apple's market cap is now back to, I think, $2.5 trillion, but it peaked at $3 trillion. And a lot of these stocks, they're still doing great things, but the price that was paid for them during lockdown probably assumed that the growth rates they were generating then would be sustainable, which I don't think is proven to be the case. And that has challenged their valuations, particularly when interest rates have gone up. Now, if rates go down, that will also help tech stocks because they're priced ultimately on a discounted cash flow valuation, and their cash flows tend to be quite back-end loaded, certainly for some of the newbies that are up and coming. So the higher the interest rate, the higher the discount rate, the lower the net present value of the cash flow, the lower the theoretical value of the equity. But that could work the other way if interest rates start going down. But I would suspect that from my perspective on tech is, yes, great companies, but don't assume that they will be great forever, or at least don't pay any price for them. And I would be slightly concerned, and I haven't been able to verify this, by the way, Eddie, so, but I've read numbers that suggested about 90% of the upside we saw from the S&P 500 and US stocks in the first quarter of the year came from a very small handful of stocks. Now, again, I can see why they have haven appeal, net cash, competitive positions, tech worked brilliantly, but that's all very reminiscent of the Nifty 50 mentality that we saw in the early 1970s, when there were 50 stocks that just dominated. And said, well, if you own those 50, what can go wrong? Well, if you overpay for them, everything. And of those 50 stocks from then, there's barely a handful that even existed, let alone thrive. So again, I think you've got to be careful in your assumption that because they're dominant now, they'll be dominant forever. And if you look at what does a company in, what it's either they do something egregious because they get lazy and they annoy the customers. And you could argue that going back to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, maybe that's what started to unseat what is now Meta Platforms come Facebook as it was. Competition ships in. Well, there's no shortage. If people are making good money, then somebody's going to try and have a crack at you somewhere. Or the regulator gets involved and gets annoyed with you. And you can argue that big tech to varying degrees does face all three of those things. So again, I wouldn't want to presume forever that they can be top dog. And if you look right now at Apple, Foxconn's just slipped out a profit warning. The chip stocks are knocking out profit warnings. TSMC just had its worst month. The world's leading semiconductor foundry had its worst month for sales since May 2019. So there are signs that the supply chain, yes, it's unblocking, but it's unblocking because supply has ramped up at a time when demand has started to ease, either because lockdown pulled it forward or because the consumer's under duress or whatever it happens to be. So even then, I wouldn't want to take too much for granted, even in the short term. Long run, at the moment, phenomenal companies, but don't pay any price for them and assume they're invincible, because unsinkable sounds too much like invincible sounds too much like unsinkable, said the Hindenburg to the Titanic.
Yeah, it'll be super interesting to see earnings season. And obviously, the outlook for rates arguably is less high than it has been, maybe rate cuts, maybe at the end of this year or into next year. But the economy will challenge potentially those earnings, like we saw with Apple, -40% on their PC sales, for example. So these companies are not immune to the economic cycle, although they are, you know, cash flow generating machines. But the impression that I get for you is that now we're in an environment with viable alternatives, right? And that could be fixed income, even much short duration money market funds. I've obviously seen massive flows. Gold, with potentially the US dollar debasing or at least declining this year after a strong year last year. But we are entering this recession. So what does your kind of recession playbook look like now and for the rest of the year? How should investors be thinking about a diversified portfolio and what looks attractive to you now and could do depending on what you see?
Valuation is the greatest tool, and it's what the one thing that grad valuation doesn't do is time markets. I saw it with tech stocks in 1998. You know, the team I was working with put out a big thing in mid 99 saying this is nuts, the market's lost its mind, you're gonna have to be really, really careful here. The Nasdaq went up by another 50%, so we nearly all got ourselves fired because we were out there saying this is all rubbish. And our investment bankers were saying, we're missing out on all these deals. Look at all these paydays. Duh. And we were saying, well, they're all going to be trash. They're all going to be worth zero in 3 years' time. So it's all a matter of timing, right? It's like Mike Burry in the film The Big Short. You know, his clients are pulling their money out saying, well, you're wrong. The US housing market isn't going to collapse. And he's saying, I'm not wrong. I'm just early. And it turned out he was 2 years early. So, you know, there's an element of it all being in the timing, right? But so valuation is not a timing tool. I can stand outside my house and jump up and down till I'm blue in the face and argue that something's expensive, but it won't stop it getting more expensive if the market's got the bit between its teeth and something doesn't change to change perception. So I think that's the first thing. But what I would say is that valuation will always protect you in the end from overpaying and getting sucked in. and it will always give you a chance to protect yourself on the way down and then make money on the way up. But it's never going to help you with a timing, but it will help protect you through the more volatile times and give you opportunities. If you're looking at what's expensive, right, on the face of it, as we've kind of touched upon, on the face of it, virtually anywhere you slice them, US equities look, quote, expensive. As a percentage of global market cap, they're up at 60%. That's exactly where they peaked in 2000. Market cap to GDP, the Buffett indicator, historic highs. Professor Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings, not at its all-time high, but above 30. It's only been there two or three times before. It didn't end well, but you don't know when or why. So on the face of it, US is tricky. The UK on the face of it looks terribly cheap. But equally, you can say, well, of course it deserves to be cheap. It's packed full of this 20th century rubbish, oil, miners, banks, insurers. It's a matter of, you know, the unforecastable, the indigestible, and you can argue the interminably slow consumer staples. But that's a mix that actually might look quite good in an inflationary environment. Doesn't look good in a low growth, low rate, low duration one like the US, but in a different environment, the UK actually might have the right sort of tools to help protect you from that. So a lot of it will depend upon your worldview, and the same for emerging markets. So, you know, if you think that we're going back to low growth, low rates, low inflation, by all means, bonds will be potentially very interesting right now, particularly short duration. If you can lock in 4% on the US 2-year, that might look really quite interesting, if that's your worldview. If your worldview is that we are going to get inflation or stagflation, then they're going to be potentially more challenged. Then you're looking at more commodity exposed or more short cycle business areas like emerging markets or the UK, for example, or to a degree Germany, Europe, packed with banks, packed with high quality cyclicals. So a lot of that will depend upon your worldview. And then sector wise, in the UK, for example, banks terribly cheap. Again, you can say, well, they deserve to be. We've just had a run on US banks. We've had a major Swiss bank fall into the arms of its bitterest rival. We've got a recession coming. Don't they deserve to be cheap? Answer, probably, but then they already are. So to what degree is that bad news already priced in? And I think the real interesting test for the UK, I mean, economically, but also from a market perspective, is watch the house builders. Because if there are rate cuts coming, you would expect the house builders to start to sniff that really pretty quickly. And it's in just looking at my screen over there, they're actually having a really good day today, which is why I particularly mention it. In that, again, the UK 2-year will move before the Bank of England does. The house builders will, to a degree, feed off that. And they've gone from trading at a big premium to book value to inline or discounts, with the odd exception. And the old bank rule of thumb on the house builders is 1x book and below, they're cheap. 2x book and above, they're expensive. Then it's just a matter of waiting for something to change. And they've derated massively back to 1x book or below. And if you do sense there's a rate cut coming as things tip into recession, the builders will probably, if you look at, an example of the 1990 to 92 cycle, yes, nasty recession, builders, share prices thrived through that because they smelled interest rate cuts coming. And when the rate cuts came, then they really got motoring. So again, the builders won't wait for signs of improved mortgage applications and improved sales and improved profits. They'll have moved a long way before then. So they could be a really interesting litmus test. UK economy and where rates are going in at the moment, they look pretty cheap, and they've got net cash balance sheets, whereas 2000, they've got £4 billion of net cash between them right now, the quoted builders. 2007, they had £4 billion of net debt. So again, they've got some ballast to see them through any downturn that's coming.
Right, that's really interesting, because yeah, well, you're looking at maybe domestic property. What about commercial property? And obviously, we've discussed UBS, Credit Suisse, some breakages there. Lots of regional banks in the US, which were obviously the root of the problem, have a lot of commercial real estate exposure, very interest rate sensitive, for example. So my question is, what does that look like in terms of the ripple effects in the UK, in Europe? Is that a challenge? What does this mean for not only the banks, but maybe the non-bank lenders? Is there any challenges or things that you could see happen for the rest of this year or beyond that would keep you up at night?
As somebody who started his career in a bear market, I always think from 1991 to 93, I'm always going to slightly come at things from the dark side, because my first 18 months as a junior fund manager was spent protecting the downside. And so that's, so it was probably a bit unfortunate I was then got given tech, because it's obviously that's a very much more of a blue sky upside kind of oriented type of thing. but I was trained by a value house during a bear market, so I'm always going to be of sort of downside protection first angle. Commercial real, well, first of all, in terms of the banking wobble, I mean, it has been contained so far to three or four banks in the US and one badly run Swiss institution that had let itself down over a multiple period of time. And I'm not saying that just because I used to work for UBS. It's interesting that some of the narrative has now moved on to blaming social media for those US bank runs and technology, just because it made it easy for people to get the information and move their money around. And I guess it's nobody wants to be, you've got to be careful if you're sitting in a darkened cinema. The one thing you don't want to hear is somebody shouting fire, right? Because you're automatically going to head for the exits and take your chances later. So that's kind of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank, was there was a big shout of fire and everybody legged it. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, particularly with a badly run bank, where there were a lot of uninsured deposits, where there was a lot of excess liquidity, which had been pumped in largely by central banks, you could say, and where risk controls were poor. And I think that's with all of those institutions so far, it's been, in the American case, a surfeit of liquidity, lack supervision and regulation, and very, very weak, and then the surfeit of liquidity provided by central banks, which then ran the other way. In terms of the UK, I think our regulation is tighter. I think that there hasn't been that degree of surfeit of liquidity that we saw at those specific niche banks. And so at the moment, at least, I think the UK regulation is hanging in there pretty well. And again, also the UK banks don't trade at a premium to book value from a stock market perspective in the way that the American ones, except Citigroup, do. So again, I think you've got more downside protection in terms of valuation there, as well as regulation and risk controls relative to those US institutions that went belly up. Having said that, I think that there is a potential knock-on effect economically from those failures, because I think, you know, chief credit officers and senior loan officers will be a little bit more risk averse than they were previously. And if they see deposits leaking out the door, then that does limit a bank's opportunity to lend and ability to let and willingness to lend. So I think there is a danger that, which is why I still think there is a recession risk, probably underappreciated, because I think there could be knock-on effects there. Commercial real estate is really tricky because, you know, if you look, I mean, first of all, it's not homogenous. So if you just look at the UK as an example, looking at the REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust that we have here in the UK, you have some that are exposed to city skyscrapers, some that are retail and retail parks, some that are data centers and servers, some that are healthcare institutions, some that are domestic property, you know, commercial residential property, some that are warehousing logistics, so that some are self-storage. So you've got very, very disparate sector, and they trade at different multiples of book value. Generally speaking, over time, what you've seen is those that are the furthest away from big city skyscrapers trade at the biggest discount, trade at the higher premium. So data centers and servers have probably been, and warehousing logistics have been the highest valued relative to book value. The lowest valuations have been probably things like, you know, big city skyscrapers, so British Land and Land Securities and commercial property, whereas the big premium with healthcare somewhere in the middle. So again, the REITs trade at some very big discounts to book value now, particularly in the areas that you've just touched upon, like commercial. I mean, I probably now work in the office 2 or 3 days a week, but I'm sat at home right now, as you can tell from the bookcase behind me. And I don't think that there will be a monster dash back to the office, even though JP Morgan is now apparently telling all of its senior execs to get their backsides in there 5 days a week. So I think in that respect, there will be a constraint on demand for commercial real estate, for example. Equally, if you look at Great Portland Estates this week, you know, rents are still very strong. It's just had a record year for rents. And so I think it's a bifurcated market in that new modern buildings, lots of light, lots of air, lots of ventilation, gyms, nice cafes, still very much in demand. Older buildings that don't offer those, not quite so much. And so again, if you look at what Landsec and British Land are doing, they're busily recycling their assets as best they can and developing a new one. So they might not be quite as heavily hit as everybody might think. But yeah, in the event of a recession, things will clearly get harder, and they will see some increase in voids and increase in non-rental payment. But at the moment, at least, rental income looks okay, and they're terribly cheap. So they're if anything, from an investment point of view, they're almost in the too hard pile. Terribly cheap, no immediate positive catalyst, lots of economic cross currents. Real contrarians might be tempted, but I think for a lot of people, they're probably still too early. But I think in the US, again, the regional bank exposure to commercial real estate is definitely something that we need to keep a close eye on. Particularly, there's a big wave of refis due by 2024, 2025. It's not far away. And again, I think it's another reason why I'd be a little bit wary of the optimism that still seems to pervade the US equity market particularly.
Yeah, isn't it funny that office blocks make up the majority of most REITs, commercial REITs, because they were thought to be the safest, you know, form of commercial real estate. And now, you know, the tide's turned and the world's changed. And now it's all about data centers. And I think Blackstone just raised a $30 billion fund to pursue these opportunities in, you know, lab offices, healthcare, data centers. So there are opportunities for those. Obviously, retail investors can't necessarily, you know, get direct exposure to that very easily. But there's lots of opportunities within this kind of recession playbook. There was one, there was one brilliant article that I read of yours, which was about bubbles. And that's what I'd like to kind of end the article, the podcast on. Bubbles may change, but their evolution stays fairly consistent. So what are the signs? Arguably, we had in 2021 the big re-rating of softwares, you know, SaaS companies, tech companies. Obviously, last year was very much a bad year for bonds. Obviously, the 60-40 portfolio had its worst year, I think, since 1930s. So what bubble elements do you see now, and what are the signs of any that you see right now?
Yeah, I think we've probably seen a rolling deflation or bursting of bubbles, if anything, which is actually quite a healthy thing. So if you look, since we've really had what interest rate increases starting 15 months ago, we've had cryptocurrencies. All right, I know Bitcoin's back above 30 now, and it's actually having a ripping run, which I'm still trying to slightly understand because I'm not naturally a crypto person anyway, being of a certain vintage. But crypto, lots of cryptocurrencies have fallen to earth hard and are not coming back, and non-fungible tokens the same. Initial public offerings have cooled. Meme stocks have, you know, largely come down, albeit with some extremely violent rallies. SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, that fad seems to have come and gone. Gilts and bonds, as you say, had a blow up, and particularly UK gilt had a massive blow up last autumn thanks to Trussonomics and Quartingomics. And then we've seen, you know, banking stocks. You've had this rolling ripple effect of things that have done incredibly well starting to go wrong and derate and having offered a lot of financial gain now offer a lot of financial pain. And so I think that's, although it's not pleasant for anybody who's got money involved there, it's actually probably quite healthy in that money now has a real opportunity cost again. You know, UK base rates are 4 and change. The federal funds rate is a 5%. Find the right tool, you can get 4-5% for doing nothing. All right, inflation has to be taken into account. But I think that will persuade people to be a little bit more aware of the fact there is an opportunity cost to money. When money has no opportunity cost, you'll be pretty free and easy about it and potentially do dangerous, silly things with it. I think that's largely what we've seen. So if you look at a classic bubble cycle, well, yeah, you do have a genuine innovation, a genuine disruption that appears. And there are loads of brilliant books on bubbles. I use the Kindleberger model from Manias, Panics and Crashes. But Edward Chancellor wrote a terrific book called Devil Take the Hindmost. Professor John Turner's written a really good book on them from Queen's University Belfast quite recently. And Richard Buxtable's book, Demon of Our Own Design, is a terrific history of financial crises and their origins. And the reason that we still get crises is that, yes, regulation changes and circumstances change, but human behavior doesn't. And ultimately, that's what it's all about. You can try and regulate human behavior until you're blue in the face. People will get excited and get greedy, and then they'll get frightened and they'll get scared, and that prompts the buying and that prompts the selling, and that's that. So the classic cycle is, yes, you get a disruptive innovation that is genuinely really exciting. Whether it's canals, railways, Latin American mines, technology, property, you know, exotic derivatives on property and mortgages, whatever that happens to be. And that initially goes really well because it does what it does. It disrupts and it creates productivity and it breeds success, and then you get share prices going up and then more people pile in because they're frightened of missing out. And then you get the copycats appearing, more credits thrown at it. Everything keeps on going up. And then the first stumble is, well, the insiders start selling. There's a rash of IPOs, then there's a rash of secondary offerings. Management teams start unloading stock, which you definitely did see, by the way, quite a lot in the US, particularly in 2020, 2021, 2022. And that starts the first, oh, what am I missing? And the answer is, well, actually nothing, because I'm going to buy another dip, because that's what's worked brilliantly for so long, and why wouldn't I? And then you get more IPOs and more secondary offerings and more management sellings, and then something goes wrong. There's an IPO that goes thud or whatever it happens to be. And that's when the mentality changes from buying the dips to sell into the rallies. And a really good hedge fund management client of mine in Boston, when I was at the bank, he always used to say he was always very wary of shorting cult stocks until they'd halved. He says, once they halve, then buy on the dip becomes sell on the rally. Psychologically speaking, people start, the wet towels start to come slopping into the ring. And that's when the bubble really starts to lose air. And then the final stage is normally a whacking great scandal of some kind or other, where people really feel, oh, I've been taken for a bit of a mug here. And then, okay, I'm out, I'm done. And so that's kind of five or six stages. Now, I think in some cases, we've probably been right around that cycle and we're going back to the start. I think in some cases, we're probably still somewhere near the top. And in some cases, we're probably quite near the scandal. So I think in that kind of rolling bubble thing that we've had, I think we're in different stages. We're in differing stages. But investors at least then have got a framework for feeling what they think might be. Because in the end, the buying opportunity is when there's revulsion. People have given up. It's like, oh, I've been... And so long as there's a genuine investment, a genuine asset in there, which there'll always be a nugget of them somewhere, that's potentially really, really interesting, as proved to be the case in tech. You know, tech did everything and more that was expected of it in that 2000 to 2003 bubble. Just didn't do it as quickly as people hoped. And the prices that were built in were unsustainable in the short term. So again, valuation was your guide that there was danger here. But in 2003, if you bought then, you had to be very patient. Tech didn't really start moving till 2006-07. And in the end, if you bought in 2003, you didn't get your money back on the NASDAQ until 2013. But once it turns, it can really turn. So I think there's lots of things I've seen in the last 3 years that remind me very much of 98 to 2000 and a lot of this Kindleberger stuff. Some of it is still potentially looking pretty bubbly. Some of it's gone wrong. Some of it's going wrong. But it's a really, really useful framework.
Yeah, and it's a perfect segue. I love that line about human psychology doesn't change. So to end this podcast, for all our listeners, given that we've been through that bubble over the last 3 years and we're heading maybe to the start of a new cycle, new period with a new investment regime where tech stocks won't do amazingly well, potentially, or long-term capital market assumptions aren't as high, and there's other alternatives, what should retail investors have in mind in terms of their psychology with their portfolios, with their investing for this year, which is likely to be very volatile, as we've seen already?
Yeah, I think it is keep an open mind. I think it was Frank Zappa who said that the mind is like a parachute, works best when open. And I think it's just don't assume that we're going back to low growth, low rate, low inflation sludge. And don't assume that central banks are going to get it right. They'll try. But policy error is in many ways the investor's biggest enemy. And I think the one thing that could trip central bankers up this year is oil. Because in the end, if you look at the inflation deceleration we've had so far, much of it is energy and gasoline at the pumps. So OPEC has just, you know, given that one a bit of a tug with its production cut and get crude oil popped back up again. So if you suddenly saw for any reason crude oil back at $100 or more, or back to its peaks last year of 120, that will be a thoroughly unpleasant situation for central bankers, because they can't print oil to depress the price. The Americans have just said they want to start replenishing their strategic petroleum reserve. You know, China is still reopening. We still aren't drilling for oil because it's seen to be a bad thing, and there's pressure on drillers not to drill from their banks, their insurers, their shareholders, the public and politicians. And so understandably, they're keeping drilling pretty tight. So if there's a nasty surprise this year, it could be oil, because we've seen it dribble. We've seen it come back a long way, and we've got government support schemes that are still running but are due to expire. So if there's a nasty surprise, that's it. A good surprise, therefore, would be oil, you know, staying at $80 and going below, or even going back to 60, 70s. That would be a huge help to everybody. But if we did get inflation, then you'd need, then, you know, having a balance for all the scenarios is probably an interesting way of thinking about it. Because historically, inflation has been good for cyclical, short-duration assets, commodities and hard stuff. Disinflation, low inflation, deflation good for paper assets, cash, bonds, long-duration assets, tech and anything that's got growth. Stagflation, worst of all worlds. We've only had one example, the 1970s. What did then? Well, what did well then? Defense stocks, consumer staples, anything you put down your throat or the sink because they've got pricing power, and gold. So, and I think gold probably isn't an inflation hedge as such, because it's probably more a loss of faith in policymakers, loss of control, which is what you saw in the late 70s, what you saw in the 2000s. Central bankers were behind the curve, and I think there's that slight sense they are now, and that's why gold's gone back above 2000. So three scenarios, three fisheries in a guide portfolio solutions, probably therefore having a bit of a mix of all three might be a way of protecting yourself. But I think ultimately, just because something's worked well for the last 10 years, don't assume it's going to work well for the next 10, because history would suggest that actually that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's a brilliant way to end this. So, Russ, thank you for an absolute masterclass.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure our listeners will get a huge amount of value from this. If anyone wants to find you, what's the best place? Twitter, LinkedIn?
I'm on both, so they're quite happy to hunt me down there. I would just say, just having had an email from my IT security people, there are some WhatsApp channels out there that are bearing my name that are not me, and they're giving investment advice. Now, AJ Bell is not authorized to give investment advice. So anywhere the way you see me giving investment advice on the internet, I will promise you for free, it's not me and it's nothing to do with AJ Bell either. So please be careful.
Yeah, had a few of those on my LinkedIn inviting people to Telegrams. I will never open a Telegram channel. A good warning there. So yeah, Russ, thank you very much, and I'll see you next time.
Pleasure. I look forward to it.